to resume the hearing. Mr. Todd.
Yes, sir.
Can we just look back to the previous discussion on the shores of the Clwyd River?
Yes.
There is a separate issue regarding a submission seeking that the rural residential area, I think it's above Ricos Point, be removed from the plan. This commission being by Forrest and Bird, and I think that Mr. Cooper had a further submission in of opposition.
Not his land.
That was the thing that was puzzling me, that in terms of the map that you've drawn, that's not his land.
Not his land. The rural residential?
Yes.
No.
So. Thank you for the clarification. I just wrote that down. Maybe wrong, but it was his, Mr. Cooper's first submission that was in his land. For the shores of Lake Hawea.
Shores of Lake Hawea, that's correct. So I appear for two submitters who are related, Glenn Dean Limited and Mr. and Mrs. Burden, who are the principals of Glenn Dean Limited, are sitting on my far left. And Mrs. Burden has also filed a personal submission. And the submissions relate to two properties. They relate, first of all, to the Hawea camp, which is owned by a sister company to Glen Dean Limited, which the Burdens are principals of.
Could I invite you to clarify that? I think you might mean leased.
Leased. The camp facilities are owned, but leased from the council.
Yes.
And there is a submission seeking that land be rezoned rural visitor to enable further development of the camp. And then there is a second submission which seeks some rural lifestyle zoning around the Glen Dean homestead, which is further north on the western banks of Lake Hawea. So I wonder if we can deal with the camping ground first, sir. And there is a potential issue that has been highlighted, you may have seen in the last week or so, by a minute that I raised following an issue raised by the planning officers in respect of the mapping hearings in the Wakatipu, or the Queenstown mapping hearings, which are going to be heard, submissions on that are going to be heard sometime in July, I think, in August. And there was a concern raised that people seeking rural visitor, as is the case with Glen Dean and Mr. Burden's submission before you today, shouldn't really be before you because the rural visitor zone does not form part of the hearings on stage one of the proposed district plan. And my difficulty with that argument is that these are meant to be mapping hearings, and people have been invited to make submissions in respect to what they seek to have their land zoned. And the Glen Dean and Mrs. Burden have responded to that by suggesting that their land be rezoned rural visitor. And they accept that the rural visitor zone provisions are not going to form part one of the plan. But in my submission to you, that does not prevent or cause any difficulty in them seeking that their land be so zoned, given that these are mapping matters which are part one. And I think you may have raised Board of Finance, I misquoted you, you may have raised an interesting issue early on the hearings, that if people don't seek to rezone their land or don't seek to make submissions on the mapping zones at this stage, they could be left out in the cold if, for example, a zone is not promoted as part of stage two. And it's been suggested by Commissioner Nugent that it may well be that the rural visitor zones may not form part of the proposed district plan in the future. And if that's the case, I suggest the council's got a real problem, because, and it's not really applicable to today's hearing, but if I can give you the rationale. If I have land zone currently shown in the notified plan as being a rural visitor, and I don't make a submission, I just accept that, and I don't make any submission, and then the rural visitor doesn't eventuate, rural visitor zone doesn't eventuate as part of part two, where does that leave me? Because presumably, if it's not going to be rural visitor, it's probably going to be rural landscape classification, or it may be ONL or something like that, and I may not have made a submission on it. And this is the danger which a number of us suggested to the council from the outset when they suggested that they were going to hear these hearings in two or more parts. And it's also relevant for today's hearing, because Commissioner Nugent suggested in the minute where he responded to the memorandum that I raised these concerns last week by saying, well, it might be open for us to seek rural visitor zoning for the land, but we'll need to show that that meets the strategic direction provisions. Presumably, those that were notified, or if I'm wrong about those that were recommended by the planning officers in their section 42A report. And again, I've got some real issues around whether or not it's going to be possible for you to confirm the strategic direction provisions of the district plan when you haven't heard part two or other parts of the district plan. And I'm going to be very interested to see how that is dealt with. In terms of the release of decisions. But reverting back, there's my submission to you that it is open for Burdens and their company to seek rezoning. And I've had Mr. White prepare as part of his summary of evidence some points of evidence which address specifically the issue about how such zoning would be in accord with strategic direction provisions as amended and recommended in the section 42A report by the council, assuming in doing so that that is the council's current position on subject to your decisions, the council's current position on the strategic direction provisions. Well, a little bit of context, just unless you want to.
Well, I think we can short circuit the discussion. In her opening submissions to us, council accepted this is not a scope issue.
Right.
That any person whose land is notified in part one of the district plan review can seek a different zone to that which is ascribed in the plan maps.
Yes.
I was going to suggest to Mr. White that he had a technical problem seeking amendments to the operative district plan, since that's not in front of us. But equally, that is easily fixed, so long as you're talking about there are in fact two rural visitor zones. The one that's in the ODP and the one that you're selling.
That's right.
So, and I think the, in terms of Commissioner Nugent's concern about anyone putting up an ODP zone showing that it's consistent with the strategic directions, my observation is the way Mr. White writes his planning evidence. He references back both to the more specific zone objectives and indeed to the strategic objectives.
Yes.
So others might not have that problem, but I don't think Mr. White does.
No. I'm very glad you shortcutting it to that extent.
And so the last point of observation is that while the council's opening submissions, except that it wasn't a scope issue, that it did suggest that the remedy, should the, and this is for your information, should the panel find merit in a request such as yours, on behalf of the Burdens in relation to campground, is for the panel to recommend that land be notified. That land be notified as part of stage two in the revision of the rural visitor provision.
Yes.
That suggestion is open to the objection that Commissioner Nugent has already identified, that of course at this point no one can bind the council as to what it notifies as part of stage two. We can make suggestions, but it will be the council's decision.
Yes,
so that's a long way around saying I don't think, with a bit of tweaking of Mr. White's evidence, I don't think you have an issue in substance. And clearly, we are open to be persuaded on the merits that, in effect, a PDP rural visitor zone is the appropriate zone for this land. As always, the question is whether you can convince us that that is the most appropriate way to give effect to the relevant objectives.
Well, we'll try hard to do so. Just a little bit of context. A camping ground has existed on this property, on the council's property, for an excess of 46 years. The Burdens purchased this property to enable some diversification in terms of their farming, purchased the business, to provide diversification as far as their farming operations are concerned. They have land which is immediately adjoining the camping ground, noting that not all of the council land is designated as camping ground. And noting that at this point the council has not sought to extend the existing designation. That causes practical issues when it comes to undertaking improvements to the campus ground, that improvements within the designated portion are generally, and I say generally, easier to consent. Those outside, whilst it has a rural general zoning, per se, are much more difficult to consent. The Burdens are anxious and keen to take the camping ground from its traditional business model, being a camp for Kiwi campers over the summer months, to one which is much more sustainable and being all year round camping ground, but that in itself necessitates buildings rather than traditional campsites where people might tent or caravan.
Like a top 10 with
correct
with cabins.
That's
in,
correct.
In the law.
Yeah. So that's the context of it. And now I might pay for if Mr. Burden can be given as a non-expert the ability to speak to you in relation to the issues that they're facing and the reasons why they want him to do to see the zone, the land rezoned, and then I'll call the experts and then we can revert to the second part of the submission in relation to the rural lifestyle portion.
Okay, well, happy to deal with cabin ground first, then the Glendine homestead.
Yes, because the specialists will talk about both.
Yes,
the experts. Sorry.
And one point of clarification that maybe with Mrs. Burden, she said land immediately adjacent. I had understood that the land immediately up the lake was owned by the Burden Senior. Is that not right as the?
Absolutely not.
No.
It's owned by Glendine
Holdings. Right.
The 7 hectares around the back of between the road and the camp.
Oh yes, so the camp,
the
your land,
and then
Burden Senior land,
yes.
Then Glendine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
Gotcha.
That's correct.
Part is part, and then there's a further complication because Contact Energy have an area between the two portions of land which we seek to have rezoned, which they are able to flood, and hence the reason there's a separation there, but Mr. Burden can explain that.
Yes, yeah, so, we cruise down there, and it's obvious where it is because it's the low point in the property.
And those two areas which we seek to rezone are actually physically separated by a headland from the rest of the Glendine / Borchard properties in the north.
Got it.
Sarah.
Okay, good afternoon. So I'm Sarah Burden, and I have put in my submission for the rural visitor zone and for us, and the big note is that we've got growth and tourism projected over the coming years. And more accommodation will be needed for the growing numbers and holiday makers and temporary workers, and that's taken on the district plan section. So what we were talking about is the camping ground and the surrounding land, which is about 23 hectares. And from my point of view, or from our point of view, it's very important to have a look at this piece of land as a whole parcel. It sort of starts at the camping ground and it ends at the knob. And the point of having it as a whole parcel rather than segregated or separated or private land or rural general and camping ground is that it can be planned as a whole. And that is an important factor because this piece of land is quite special, but also it means that you can incorporate the southern beach areas into the whole area, and also it creates a lot of flow for the guests and everything to be able to utilise that whole area. And also for infrastructure purposes, it means that that whole area can be utilised and planned so that things like the region and water and power and everything can all be utilised and planned properly. So we see this actually has been really positive with the increase in visitor numbers in the area, and we think it's really important, A, to look at it as a whole piece of land, but also the joining areas, like I said, for recreation purposes, joining them both together. We're talking sort of about two-storey buildings. The height restrictions that we were looking at were average of two-storey buildings. We're not looking at high-rise buildings, and many of the current trees already exist way beyond these heights, especially the gums, and they're going to continue to grow. So if anything, it's the current trees that are destroying the view, not, we don't believe that buildings or future plantings will be affecting the view as people drive past. And it seems that some of those points that the panel was a bit worried that the development will obscure view. The current Marine Park designation already allows 40% building coverage over the whole site, and that excludes play equipment. So we're asking in this whole area for 7%. And you can look at that in a couple of ways. Helen looked at it as 21 dwellings, 500 metres square, cube or whatever. We don't see it like that. We see it as accommodation, not as dwellings, housing dwellings. So we see it as units. It could be singular one bedroom, two bedroom units, or it could be a recreation facility that might hold groups, that might be some of the buildings as well, and also some glamping areas and some more structural facilities. The area has already been highly modified. It already has accommodation and it can absorb more. The OML provisions allow development in those areas with higher potential to absorb change. So one of the problems is that the land is OML. We see that that this parcel of land is really more attached to the township rather than the OML, which is a large, to us, a large vast area of land. It is noted by State Highway 6, and it joins onto the township with a walking track, and it has the lake. So when making a decision on the zoning, is the rural visitor zone appropriate for this area? We think it is. It's important recreation and visitor facilities, including accommodation and other visitor attractions. The value that's for rural visitor zone is compact size, which the camp is. I mean, that small parcel of land is compact size. General self-sufficiency, that area of land is self-sufficient apart from using town supply water. And the distance from main urban centres. So the distance from the main urban centre is 15 kilometres to Wanaka. It's also fantastic in the fact that the piece of land is a walking distance to the local Hawea, Lake Hawea. And it is separated from Lake Hawea, but it has provided easy access to go and use the township and use the shops and restaurants. And there is some planning for some more shops in the township. And a accommodation facility like that will always support those sorts of shops and utilise the restaurants. Is this an area where accommodation can be absorbed into the community without having minimal impact? Will the development add value to the community in regards to visitor accommodation, employment, facilities and infrastructure? These are questions for the rural visitor zone. And what are the significant adverse effects? In one of the evidence, it said that the NZIT would cause sprawl and would adversely affect the natural character of the wider ONL. We don't see this as sprawl. We see this as flow, that it means that the parcel of land flows, so people can actually utilise the accommodation area and also utilise the beach areas that are in that section. By not looking at the area as a whole, you're actually stopping flow. So it's really important to look at the whole area. Obscuring valued views of ONL is another comment regarding that section. The views predominantly currently look over exotic vegetation, campground, and the township can be seen in the distance. The trees already obscure views, as they continue to grow, those views will be obscured further. I think that the development will actually cause the views to be less obscured, as buildings and plantings can have a lesser effect than current vegetation as it is in regards to its height. At the moment, the vegetation is really, a lot of those gum trees are really tall and actually obscure the view of the outbuilding as what the evidence is saying that is the outstanding natural landscape feature. The township and the regular traffic are accustomed to there being accommodation and the type of vegetation at the campground. The township again are familiar with the camping ground and to seeing it on the western shore. As you all know, when you're looking out from Lake Hawea, the camping ground on the western shore is not the prominent view that everyone looks for. Everybody doesn't turn their head and go, ooh. They're all looking majority out towards to the lake and out to Mount Patriarch area. The holiday park is not as exposed as other lakefront holiday parks such as Gendu, which is also outstanding natural landscape, and can be seen from the road and the lake, as there is no visual screening. Other holiday parks that are in other, like, say for example in Queenstown, they have a lot of buildings in there, like the Queenstown Lakeview Holiday Park. So they have also been able to absorb buildings in those areas. And because the Lake Hauwea Holiday Park is not as exposed as places like Bindu, we believe it can absorb the development and accommodation and facilities. So people like to stay in the lakefront accommodation, and this is the major attraction to getting people to visit places like Lake Hauwea. They want to stay on the lakefront. It is important that our region can offer a range of accommodation options. And like Freedom Campers, people in the holiday park also want to see the view. We do not want our visitors to be indifferent. Therefore, treating the whole park as a whole means that more lakefront access is available, because it does include private land as well. We want to be able to offer a range of accommodation to suit the different budgets, be sustainable, provide employment all year round, and be successful. So the QULDC ratepayers also benefit. The other important thing about being on the lakefront is there are not many areas that lend itself to rural visitors going like this area. It is a visitor attraction. Lake Hauwea is a visitor attraction. The rural zone allows for accommodation and facilities so that people can stay and enjoy the lakefront surroundings. People are able to freedom camp to enjoy the view without facilities. And this zone, the rural visitor zone, allows people to enjoy the surround on the lakefront with facilities. This zone is about providing facilities and accommodation, and it has more of a positive effect on the environment indirectly as well as directly. I think the creation of this zone means that there is available accommodation in the area so people can stay and enjoy the visitor attraction of Lake Hauwea, benefiting the wider community environmentally as well as socially and economically. It ticks all the boxes. Rural General is not the right zone for putting visitor accommodation into a rural area. It doesn't tick all the boxes. Rural Visitor Zone does tick all the boxes. It is one place that allows and encourages for visitor accommodation. So that's about it. What I'm just trying to say is that it's probably the most perfect area for some accommodation to be absorbed in a rural zone, in a rural area. And so I'd really like to be considered.
Thank you, Mrs. Brown. Question that occurs to me, and we've heard a lot of many apocryphal stories, or some evidence, about the desperate need for low-cost accommodation for, like, service workers. Is your intention, or and is there a risk that the kind of accommodation facilities you're talking about could be turned into a permanent town? The follow-up question would be if that is a risk, should we care? But that's a different point. I'll ask Mr. White the second point, but he didn't think about that while you were answering the first one.
The first point, not a town. We've already got Lake Hauwea right there, so no, not a town. I think more on a resort sort of level with a variety of accommodation. So and definitely short term, we'd be looking at short term. Then would probably likely to be a bit of provision for some workers' accommodation in the holiday park area, because that is what we normally do. We're usually open 24/7 and it requires workers to be close quite often to the facilities and then, you know, to the running of it. But no, definitely not a town. It would be more of an upgraded holiday park facility offering more accommodation and well-planned accommodation too. horizon. And also, it's quite a, to be able to have, to be able to be sustainable, it needs to have some accommodation in there that we can have a variety of most of our campers and whatever that come into the holiday park at the moment require en-suite facilities, and so we'd be looking at most of the accommodation having that sort of position. But yeah, no, not a town. But we'd hope to put some more facilities in there that would be more exciting for visitors to come and visit and stay longer rather than just overnight.
Like I can understand that there might be some consumer resistance to trotting across a field into shared ablution facilities on mornings like this.
It's freezing and cold on the bottom.
Any questions, Commissioner?
Yes, I have a question thank you for your evidence. I'm just interested in how far you might have got with your planning for what you envisage for expansion of the holiday park. We talked in terms of an upgraded holiday park, but can you give me some idea of what numbers you'd be looking at?
That's quite an interesting question because at peak time, our holiday park is full, and at all the other, you know, which is Christmas and New Year's, full, and all the other times, it's not full. So I would say that it would become more consistent, not with the peak time, but we're hoping for at least half, you know, like for to be occupied. We'd love to have half of that amount of people be able to come throughout the whole year. So then the peak numbers, we feel we can't actually, that's it. There's the Christmas and New Year and that summer holiday period. It's practically, for us, it's practically full.
Can you just tell me what those numbers are, the peak numbers?
So we have about 800 to 1,000 people over the Christmas and New Year period. It drops significantly straight after New Year. And that's predominantly campus.
You also asked what our proposal are. We actually have a plan going into council with the proposed development of where we're looking at extending some of the existing accommodation, putting in new glamping tents and ablution block and areas like that to service the campers. We've been looking at bringing in some geodesic domes from the USA, which is the first for New Zealand, and an amazing structure. Sarah's got an eco-tourism degree that is an important part of why we're looking at the sustainability of the camp and why the different types of accommodation that we're offering, right through from just simple tent sites, caravans, the eco-domes, which would be more of a high-end, and so it's pretty exciting. We've been employing consultants and Arrow International to help develop and look at all the infrastructure, where we've looked at waste, power, and have found, you know, and been working at upgrading the power boards and everything like that. So there's been a considerable amount of work going into that. But due to the stage of the district plan, we have to do it through a resource consent process. And as Mr. Todd talked about, the frustrations of trying to develop, it's a very costly process when we don't can't work within our current designation and campground plan.
So, I mean, we're already looking at just putting the geodesic domes in and some recreation room and extending the ablution block for the indoor engineering, because we don't have enough facilities already for that. And it's already costing us up to $100,000 to do all the preparation and resource consent for that, which to us is scary, because if we want to continue putting more accommodation in the park, we'd rather spend that money obviously on the accommodation and not on the process of trying to put it in there.
And that's why the appropriate looking for the appropriate zoning, and that's why we've, for the last 4 years, everyone knows that this review of the district plan has been on the table for a long time. I mean, we've dealt with three different levels of planners that have come and gone and talked to our people, and we've put a lot of work into why we think the rural visitor zone is the best and most important zone, and that's why we're very keen to
the whole piece of land for us would be ideally to work with council and us ourselves as private land and put a plan together that we can have rules or whatever for the rural zone. But from our point of view, that the restrictions, the height restrictions and the amount of building that can be absorbed into that area, the 7% is pretty minimal. The camping ground designation has 40% building on the entirety of their property. So we're only even asking 7%. So we're not talking about having it absolutely full of buildings. We're having it so it all can be absorbed and we can have the camping and everyone can be in there together, but they've got their own little areas or...
Presumably you'd be looking for some expansion over the peak time as well.
Well, that's on the freehold area, which has got no development at all. There's some areas there where we're looking at opening their hut, and so there's a whole 7 hectares of that area that has been modified over.
That was 7 hectares?
Seven, yes. But that's the two, there's 5.6 and 1.4 or something.
The totals are about
in the two separate areas. And those areas, we cut the grass and keep it tidy and manage, apart from there's an area of still sycamores, which, I mean, during my lifetime, my father and I have tried to run stock down there, and it's just, you get a call from the canvas saying that your cow's outside my tent, and it's not. So we can't really use it for agricultural purposes.
No. And the nice thing about the holiday park is that the terrain of it, a lot of it is sloping, so it's not actually suitable for putting tents on. So putting accommodation in is a really good way to utilise a lot of those sloped areas. And so it also means that we'd have common areas for people where there wouldn't be any camping, where they can all enjoy the view and enjoy the lake frontage. And so there'd be more common areas where there wouldn't be any building at all. So I think in the whole approach of it, we have got a vision of what we think, and it doesn't have a massive lot of buildings on it, but it needs to be sustainable so we can run it all year round, pay its staff, and also to keep people warm. I mean, inclement weather over the summer is even sometimes unbearable in this area, and it's a beautiful location, and we've got an opportunity, I think, with the rural visitor zoning to really showcase the area and put something exciting, something that simply should be proud of.
A couple of other questions. I'm interested in your comment about the geodesic zones, just in terms of the size. How many would you envisage several?
We're looking at 8 for stage one, and then there's a recreational zone, which is 13 square metres, and that is currently we don't have a recreational area in the camp where the campers, once they plug into their power site and you've spent 4 days travelling down the west coast with your husband, to go and sit quietly and enjoy the ambience. And so the big recreational zones.
Child free, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, not
quite.
So it's only half of away from the weather free.
And it sits back off the lake, and we've hit an area where we've looked at how that would fit in. And but the other drones are 7 metres square, about 40 square metres the size of them, and they have ensuite bathrooms in the deck. And if they work well, we were looking at putting further ones in the park. But the other camps that have put these in Switzerland and Norway and Africa, it's been very successful, and it's more of a high-end experience than what they would typically get at a standard campground.
The other question is, is it possible that the land that's not yet developed, if your zoning request is successful, would that potentially be a separate entity from the existing campground?
Well,
could it be? If you're not intending to.
The campground is leased, and so it's probably not. We'd be doing that, so.
Can I put it a different way? Right now there's an existing functioning campground, and you've mentioned that it doesn't have many permanent facilities. Has some. My reflection of the site visit is that you have some. So is it possible to create new facilities that would serve only the land that we're seeking zoning for? So the existing campground would continue to function, and an extended campground could be run as a separate.
We're looking at it as a whole, and there would be some issues there. Currently, we've got one access point for transit.
I was going to ask about access as well.
So if we own all the services as well, like all the water, the pipes and the electricity, all the infrastructure that goes with the park as well. So in separating, from our point of view, like for septic and sewage, and to us it seems more logical to keep it all as a one piece of parcel of land, and so that A, you're not doubling up on septic and all those sorts of things and treating them differently, but actually having it so the plan can actually absorb the accommodation and fitting well and really run really well, rather than having one septic over here that belongs to that piece and this piece.
So
ideally it would be better to have it all as one home.
But potentially when our lease runs out at the end, there could be two separate areas, because
they could be two separate entities.
Yes.
And you touched on access, so this is limited access to St Highway?
Well, it can't be limited access. We've got 140 boats going out during the peak summer period, and up to 1,000 campers coming and going. And we've actually displacing some camping, because you've got 250 tent sites and 90 power sites and then cabins and cottages. So really, we've had this discussion a couple of times. We're actually displacing some tent sites into reallocating those to either a permanent. So we don't see a major change there. And what we actually legally owned, Glendine legally owned the access to the campground during our tenure review. We traded that access to allow legal access into the campground. So there is potential to form another access on freehold via the, but would require some transit on there.
Right. So you're saying it's not limited access road, but you're
it probably is a limited access road being a state highway, but at the moment it wasn't an issue for the current resource consent that we're looking at, because we were talking about putting in 8 more drones and displacing existing.
Maybe that Mr. White can help. I'm really just wanting to understand the process that would be required. I accept that whatever you do, you will talk to transit, and it may be that there's some agreement over changing the existing access or whatever the best solution. But it was more in terms of looking ahead, if you have a limited access road, what that might mean in terms of needing a separate access point.
We had upgraded the visual, when we bought the camp, overgrown with trees, and we've been in several negotiations. My mother, who's involved with the Hawea community, has had several Hawea association. We've been involved with numerous meetings with transit, and we're looking at lighting, we've been looking at speed issues, so that's been an ongoing discussion that we've had, and something that we're working with the Hawea community association with. And
the NZCA, when I spoke to them the other day, their main concern was if there was any more pressure put on. Existing pressure put on. The only time that there's a lot of pressure is over the Christmas New Year period. And as much as we'd love to have campers coming in 100 miles an hour, that might cause a problem in the future, is that we might be restricted on the number of people we can actually have at that time of year. But for all the other times of year, the camping ground is relatively quiet, unless it's Easter or, you know, we might have a few more bands coming at Easter, but majority of the other time of the year it's reasonably quiet and there's not a lot of access issues at all. So it's only really that Christmas New Year period, and it might look at limiting or improving the access way. And that we have to work with council on that.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Burden. Any questions for Mr.
Burden? Yeah, just one. When we went to, thanks for coming along. And when we went to have a look at it, you drove through the camp, there's a road that carries on through, and it goes through some shrubland and gets to a clearing. Mm-hmm. Is that still in the campground, or is that the bit you've got?
That's the private there.
That's the zone.
Yes.
So roughly that paddock?
Most of that paddock is actually the flood zone. So
yeah.
It's only just the end of the paddock, which is more, we've put more glamping set up down there.
Yep.
And then the rest of it is where all those gum trees are, the private land is behind the holiday park. So where the fence is the council, is where the council ends.
I'm with you. So
but the land behind the holiday park is freehold.
Right. So when the road goes up, it's that bank there that you own privately?
Yes.
Gotcha. And it's hardly surprising that your full and Christmas New Year is just one of the crosses you have to bear down here, obviously. Plus and negative.
But at the moment, like, our facilities don't accommodate for the extra people, so we're bringing in extra facilities.
Yeah.
We try and send them to the Albert Town Camping Ground, but not everyone wants to stay there because they do want a hot shower and they doesn't have the facilities it's a big thing for us, you know, with the freedom camping issues that around the district, to be able to have good, safe, secure facilities with a warm shower and stuff like that. And that's where we, you know, need the council to help us.
And the other thing is that part of the council, which is completely out of date, is the camping ground strategy that they've put in place. But a lot of it is that they were really wanting to have improved facilities, improved infrastructure, to make them top class parks, not janky old, whatever. And, you know, they're the sorts of things that have to be put into this holiday park. Not a lease of 20 years.
I was going to ask you how long you've got to run, at least 20 years.
20 years. So if we don't do any development in the next 20 years, like improving infrastructure, improving the services and things in there, then the park's just going to degrade further. Putting in some extra accommodation means that we can employ more staff, we can have consistency, we can have people in all year round. So it's actually really important for the sustainability of the park to actually really look at the accommodation part of it. And as noted, I spoke to the Kimmeroo councillor, the mayor, the other day, and he put in a blue facility at Tekapo, and it cost them $800,000. So it's not cheap to put in facilities and infrastructure into a holiday park. We're putting in at the moment an eating facility for our clients, or for our guests, and we're not actually going to be probably getting any more people at Christmas time than we already get. So the extra people, you know, the only thing that's funding that is the present price. And part of the thing is to keep the prices down as low as we can so people can afford to go camping. So in order to make this whole thing operate and be sustainable, we really need to have a look at it, putting an extra accommodation in.
And just to finish off, why the zoning is important for the Lake Hale Holiday Park and for the land that we're seeking for is that the current designations that were part of this district plan review were just rolled over. They weren't considered, and that has made our resource consent processing very difficult. And we've spoken to the mayor about this, and there's some changes afoot. But he said it needs to go through the resource management act. It could take considerable time, and therefore, you know, Sarah and I are seeking some clarity about zoning, because if you have to spend $2,000 to get a resource consent to put up a barbecue shelter in the district plan, it not only frustrates the hell out of us, but it's just overloading the council staff with, incredibly, and I thought the whole thing about the district plan was to actually give people security, give them a clear direction and everything like that. So we're finding the process pretty...
Well, we need security before we start investing money into the holiday park as well. That's probably a big thing is that it's a lot of people even say, why are we putting any money into it? We're not here just to see the holiday park degrade over the next 20 years. We actually want to improve it and make it a top-notch holiday park and other utilise the whole bit of land. So.
Even though we just lease it, we look at it as an important asset, and we look as if it is ours, and we are keen to work with the council on it. So it is a frustrating process, though, when you don't have clarity, and that's why we're very keen to, in submitting today, get some clarity.
But also, the rural visitor zone, as I've said, it actually fits that parcel of land. It ticks all the boxes. It allows accommodation in that area. It allows people to come and visit Lake Hawea and stay and enjoy the vistas, just like people come to Wanaka and the other places. There's not a lot of room for accommodation in the Hawea Township. There's tiny little zoning.
In essence, it's 20 years long enough.
For the lease. We're 46 and we'll be 66 by then, and hopefully the council will like what we're doing and extend our lease. And that's something that they've said in the strategies and everything, that it's something that we discuss later on.
After you've invested in the council?
Well, you either invest or you don't. Yeah.
No, it has been put on the table.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Right, one to go first.
Thank you. Shall I restrict what I say to the camp for now, or should I? Okay. Again, I think maybe the most useful is if I just take you through the appendices of my evidence, because I think they'll clarify a few things or show a few things. So, appendix one is to do with the rural lifestyle zone, so we'll skip that. Appendix two is just a broad scale A3 map showing the location of these things. So obviously at the bottom there you can see Hawea Township, and then as Mrs. Burden has pointed out, via a walking track is connection to the campground, which is the proposed rural living zone. So then over to my appendix three is the rural lifestyle zone again, so I'll skip that. Appendix four is parcels of land that make up the proposed rural living zone. So the one there we can see, the biggest block, part section 2, block 2, Lake Hawea Survey District, 15.7 hectares, that's the council-owned land. Then the bank part that we were talking about, lot 2, DP418972, 5.6 hectares, that's the freehold land owned by Glendine, that's proposed to be inside the zone. And You're correct in thinking that a lot of that, or part of that anyway, is the steep bank that runs down from the road. But quite a bit of that is flat as well. At the very back of the campground, there's flat area that goes into that block that's currently unused. And then if we go up to the north, we've got lot 1BP418972, 1.4 hectares. That's this other small part that's to the north of the contact flood piece of land. And so that's replacing part of the river zone as well. So those three blocks are the river zones. Just going over to Appendix 5, that's proposed height restrictions on the land, so really the closest to the lake, 5.5, and then as we get back into that freehold land, 8 metre height limit.
Excuse me, just for clarification, does the council designation cover the whole 15.7 hectares or some subset of it?
It covers a very small part.
How big is it? Is it dictated area? Thank you.
2.4.
But we've recently put a submission to the district plan asking for that designation to be extended over the whole area.
Which is similar to all the other lot of parks in the area. They've all got designation over their whole area, not just
parks. And so we're waiting for the council to come back because it's actually fine for us, and it's actually a council process.
Yeah.
I'll just confirm that here. It's obviously at 2.8 degrees.
2.8.
And then if we skip over to my last bin, it's bin 6. These are two photos from Harvey Township looking towards the proposed rural visitor zone area. You can see across the area of lake surface, starting at the left hand side, probably the top photo is the easiest one, starting at the left hand side we've got the sort of boat launching ramp area at the hard left, then moving through the campground, obviously even the campground itself is quite heavily treed. If we keep moving to the right, we come to an open area between the dense trees, and that little open area is the contact floodland. And then moving to the right of that again, where the trees start again, that's the other part of the rural visitor zone.
So just for clarity, that's the open area?
Yes.
Right, we'll start writing on you.
So, hopefully those appendices clarify some things. I've just skipped to my bits of my executive summary and my conclusions. In relation to the proposed area of rural visitor zone, Ms. Melsop's evidence expresses general agreement that the relevant area can absorb development, but has some concerns regarding the degree of certainty that the operative rural visitor zone provisions give in relation to the ultimate form of that development that will occur. The relief now sought in relation to the proposed rural visitor zone has been amended, and additional restrictions are now proposed. So that's the 7% coverage and the height restrictions and 20% setback from the highway and residential activity non-compliance. I consider the relief that's now sought is appropriate in terms of its landscape and visual effects, and I consider that Ms. Melsop's concerns have been alleviated. That's probably enough of a summary for today's purposes. I'm happy to answer any questions on
this. Excuse me. The only question I have for you is that product of our site was a wheel which has pushing the clouds everywhere through the camping ground down the drip, which is obviously the contact flood easement, and then up and stopped on the other side. And when I look back, I can see the road very clearly. So the question for you is, will passing traffic look down directly onto that 1.4 hectare block, whatever it is? And is that an issue that we need to be concerned about?
Well, I think in part, passing traffic will look into these areas, and I've discussed that in the evidence. I guess the overall point that I come back to in that regard is if we go to my zoomed out plan, which is my appendix 2, I've concluded really in relation to visual effects, particularly as being from the state highway. Currently, the camping facilities are visible. You pass this site, you know it's a campsite, and you head north and pretty quickly past it, and off you go into the lakes and mountains sort of landscape. I think that will continue to be the case, albeit that the node you pass will be a wee bit bigger. I don't think that's a problem in itself. I think the 20-metre setback and how that 20-metre setback is treated is important, and I think the council control at the time of resource consents obviously can cover that 20-metre setback. The 20-metre setback will be within the site of development. And so I'd like to see the controls used to investigate some details about how that 20-metre setback is treated. Obviously the activities themselves will be controlled in terms of location and landscaping and that sort of thing, colours of buildings, what have you. And we've got 7% coverage as well, because so we're not talking about looking at a dense area of development, we're looking at clusters or a scattering. So I ended up being comfortable that, well, that the controls that are in place are such that somebody using that road will be aware they're passing a node of development. They'll probably be aware it's visitor accommodation development, really, rather than residential development. And they'll see the node for what it is, and if it's treated attractively, I think that's positive. And again, quickly they'll be past that node and they'll be off into the farmland of Glendean and overlooking the lakes and mountains and off up towards Kirstenbush and what have you, and it'll be a pretty minor blip on their experience of the outstanding natural landscape and not necessarily a negative one. So that's where I arrived at. Well, obviously you can see the Harvey Township as well as you're going past that part, particularly if you're coming from the north.
To me, that's the main view that the trees and things are already obscuring is the township.
Yes, that's any questions for us? No. Should we go on to Mr. White?
Yes.
I suppose the question is for you, Mr. White, is have you just tabulated what was already in a final put in table form what is in 6.3 and 6.4 of your evidence?
It's a slightly different assessment.
But the reference point is the 42A version of the strategic objectives.
Correct.
Commercial advice suggests we're just spending 2 minutes reading.
Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. White, about that tabulated assessment? Accepting that we have the exigencies of just reading it.
Mr. White, my question is not so much to do with the assessment per se, but essentially the matter that's already been raised by Mr. Berger, but I think it's pretty fundamental, and that is the Section 32 evaluation of costs and benefits and efficiency and effectiveness, etc. Now, your evidence is saying that if this land is zoned visitor accommodation, then a resource consent will still be necessary for a discretionary activity. And I'm just wondering, in terms of all of those tests under Section 32, what the main difference would be between the zoning as thought and what Mr. Burns says he will need to, and this is Burns, of course, what will need to be processed and what analysis will be undertaken right now of this current zoning.
There's two things to look at here. First of which is the actual zoning itself, and a rural visitor accommodation, a rural visitor zone on the surface of it seems to be the appropriate zone for an existing visitor accommodation activity. Given the premise of that, it would seem logical that visitor accommodation is provided for in the zone, whereas that is not provided for in the current rural general zone or the proposed rural zone. The difference that arises from that is that you have an expectation of visitor activities occurring in a rural visitor zone, which you certainly don't have in the rural zone. The zoning provisions themselves in the rural visitor zone specifically provide for visitor activities, whereas the rural zoning doesn't. And because of that, the rural visitor zone is a whole lot more efficient in a cost sense than the rural zone.
Are you saying, if I might sum it up, that under rural visitor zoning, that because there is an expectation that that's a legitimate and expected part of the zone, that there will be a consent granted in something like that?
It's more likely that you get a consent granted.
More likely.
Whereas under the discretionary regime of the rural zone, there is no assumption that you would get that consent granted. You can simply put your application in and then let it run through the process and see what comes out the other end.
Alright. I don't need to take any
further. Thank you. Anything from you, Commissioner McLeod, before I ask Mr. White to finish his summary?
Not at this stage, not this specific thing.
Please carry on.
Starting paragraph 7. Submissions 282 from Sarah Burden and 384 from Burden Dean seek to rezone the existing Kauri campground and adjacent land owned by a commercial station for the existing campground from rural to rural visitor zone. My evidence modifies and refines the alleged source of the submission to incorporate a new rural visitor zone area, the Hawea campground, within chapter 12.3 of the operative district plan. Revised provisions are proposed to apply specifically to the campground. These provisions have been specifically designed to address concerns about the type and scale of development provided for the rural visitor design and to preserve the lower density open space and relaxed lakeside character of the Lake Hawea campground and its domination by mature trees. The height plan that Mr. Jesse talks about included in the submission is sufficiently detailed to define the proposed height limits and geographically referenced in order to be able to control some of those effects. The evidence considers the proposed rezoning against requirements of Section 37.0A of the Act. It's considered that the rural visitor zone objects and policies are more appropriate to achieve sustainable management. fiscal resources in a sufficient area than those of the proposed rural chapter, and will be efficient and effective in achieving the objectives and policies of the strategic direction chapter of the proposed district plan, as well as sustainable management in an overall sense. I note that the landscape architects, Ms. Nelson, Council, and Ms. Steffel submitter, agree the majority of the submission area has the ability to absorb additional campground buildings and development to result in existing facilities, vegetation cover, and proximity to Harvey Township. Mr. Barr's rebuttal includes some comments on infrastructure. The proposed 7% total building coverage indicates that intensive commercial accommodation development is not anticipated at a campground. The proposed development will require connections to water supply, including firefighting, and these may entail upgrades to the water supply system. These can be designed and funded as part of the development of the campground. It is likely that wastewater will be treated and disposed of on site. This is also a matter of detailed design and development stage, although the possibility of connecting into the reticulated wastewater system has also been noted. Traffic upgrades to the internal camp layout will be required as the camp develops, and those are also a specific design matter. The proposed provisions avoid inappropriate development within the LML and on the margins of Lake Harrier, and are considered to appropriately avoid the or mitigate against adverse landscape effects, landscape character, and visual amenity. It is considered that there will be limited adverse environment effects, no cultural effects, and social and economic benefits arising from the proposal. The risks of acting or not acting are certainly considered. It is considered that there is very limited uncertainty and sufficient information in order to make a decision on the submissions. Any risk associated with rezoning sought is very low, as it is considered zoning, modified to suit particular site characteristics. And the site outcomes of an area where this activity already exists and has for some decades. As a result, it is sought that the submission and the modified rural visitor zone provisions be adopted for the Harvey campground.
Thank you, Mr. White. A request for you and Mr. Espy, between you, sort it out. I'm looking at Mr. Espy's Appendix 4. Would it be possible for you, between the two of you, to give us another plan, Appendix 4A, that overlays the three zones that you've identified being vegetation buffer, 8 metre high limit, 5.5 metres, 5 metre high limit. Obviously I can go from one to the other, square eyes trying to figure out which parts of the site apply to which.
Certainly we can prepare a plan like that.
Yeah. Now, just for the sake of good order, so I know what's coming. I'd like to write down when I can expect that to roll in the door. We're not particularly time sensitive, other than that we close the hearing on the 14th, and it has to be before then, because then the council team will be considering their reply. So what are you prepared to commit to?
Soon do it by the 14th.
Friday night? This Friday night, is that too close? Do you want to go into next week?
Well, you've got to be prepared this week.
No, I forgot that. Somebody else has already played that trick.
If that's the case, our office, which doesn't have the same evidence burdens as the Queensland Best Bands, can do that.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Would you like the designation here showing up?
Yes, please. We've had good thought. So can we have ask for a combined Appendix 4 showing the different height limits and the designated area?
Mm-hmm. And I shall do that by this Friday.
Yeah, 5 p.m. Friday in the hands of Ms. Prendergast, it would be appreciated. Commissioner,
I'd like to go first. Mr. White, I've got one other question, and that is just if you can tell me what or how other campgrounds are treated in the proposed plan at the moment.
Let me deal with that by running out the existing campgrounds.
Yeah, and I mean, there will be exceptions, and Mrs. Burden mentioned that they designated, but she may not mean that in the legal sense, what a designation is, so I'd just like to be clear about that.
Okay. The Albertown campground? Council owned?
And what was that? Was that a correction? As I understand it, dock.
Depends which side of the road.
Sorry?
I think it depends on which side of the road, doesn't it?
Nah, it could be a good one.
One's dock and one's council, which is leased to Queen's School, CCR.
So are they all part of the same campground, the one down by the river and then off the bridge and then the other one?
So if you were driving from Halbertown towards Harbour,
yeah,
there's a campground immediately adjacent to the road on the left that you can see from the road. And then if you were to turn off immediately after the bridge and come along the road that flows the Harbour River up, there's another campground there.
And that's one that's got the bridge over the Harbour.
Correct.
Yeah.
So
I saw that yesterday.
So docks on the right and the council's on the left. So.
And that's both those campgrounds don't have facilities except for a small toilet block.
So I'm sorry, I missed what you said about the status. So how are they defined in the plan?
They're all designated.
We can find that.
They are designated.
The
dock one. Yeah. They're all designated. Check them off this morning actually. They're all designated. And all of the campgrounds, the designation goes over the whole area. Like how we're the only one where it's only got the little square designation. It's under the designation in the district plan.
Yeah, so Mrs. Burden, just so I'm quite clear, you are familiar with the classification as a designated site?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the designation of the motor park?
That's helpful, yeah. Thank you.
Which is F in the thing. Do you want a copy of the...
No, if you have it here, I'll be able to have a look.
Yeah. But yeah, they're all designated. Well, I don't know if they're all designated F, yes, but the larger campground is designated motor camp. That's the motor camp, isn't it?
Which other ones are there?
Is the outlet camp?
What's that?
The outlet camp? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It starts with the Hood River.
It's got no facilities either, has it?
It does.
No,
yes.
It does?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure of the status of that, whether it's private or designated by council. It's certainly privately administered.
A bit of both.
Yeah, the council owns the pump.
Well, we don't need to go into every single one, but just to give an idea.
Yeah, Bender Bay is probably the best example.
Campground,
which is council owned and is designated.
And is an ONL and an overall.
On the lake front.
We know it well.
And then you've got some of the Queenstown camps, which the council managed for some time and have now leased out back to independent contractors.
Okay.
And have been highly developed.
Please don't let's start on Lakeview. Where's that? That's in Queenstown. It's a CCR got it and it's a plan change and it's a convention centre. Yeah,
And that's part of what a lot of the camping grounds have gone through, that, depending on where their location is, because it's in the middle of Queenstown, it's gone from a traditional camping ground into a highly modified
any questions? What I was going to ask you, and I don't know if you're the right person, but you're there, so why not, is if you end up with a designated campsite, another campsite which is, and then a privately owned area, and then a flood zone, and another private, how do you amalgamate them? How do they become operable as one thing, one entity?
I think you've got to have them managed as one entity, or are you thinking about how they are administered in a district plan sense?
Well, I'll start with the district plan sense, and if you can shed any light on the other, that would be great.
Just deal with the second one, because that's probably easier. I think Mrs. Burden's already covered how that they intend to manage those areas, both as part of an integrated management arrangement across all the council and the privately owned land.
In the flood zone, we'll stay as an open space area, which would be, you know, left as an open field. We've already modified that by, you know, regrassing it and stuff like that, and that's an open space area for the kids to go and bounce ball and, you know, have a soccer match. We call it the HCG, which is like the Hawaii cricket ground.
The only difference would be, I suppose, in money-wise, is that we'd have to separate some of the bookings. Would just be, because at the moment we pay a percentage of the
gross.
Of the gross, so it would just be whatever accommodation is in there, we pay a percentage of the gross, and anything that's outside might run on a different system. But that's still very easy to work out. We've got a very good RMS system, and it can calculate if we've got areas zoned in camping or whatever, that can be separated from private places.
Yep.
In a district plan sense, there's no particular issue with having a zoning separated by a different zone, or having part of the campground designated, so the council and part of the campground designated, and the private owners of the campground not designated.
Thank you.
In a big slide, it's just a matter of making sure the maps are accurately reflecting the extent of the zone, and the zone is in two parts. Close but not immediately joining locations. Well, that's the way it
is.
Now, question for you, Mr. White. Here's the figure, 40% of that coverage in the designated area. What is the actual coverage currently?
Of buildings?
Of buildings.
I only have a clubhouse.
Yeah. Very simple. Because, what I want to understand is the incremental difference between what there is there currently and 7%. Except the point that under the designation it could increase.
On practical terms, there's 10 cabins, one house, and 5 cottages, and an ablution block. And so over 2.8 hectares.
Finger in the air, square metre floor coverage?
You'd probably, one.
I think it might be better if you calculate it, yeah. And then you get the same
timetable as the way. I would think it would be less than a hectare currently out of 2.8 hectares. If I look at, the cabins are all 30 square metre type cabins. The cottages are more like 50 to 60 square metres.
So we'll say approximately. They're probably less than a hectare, but Mr. White will confirm by measuring it. Now, in terms of your comparison of the objectives and the rural visitor objectives, look at the very first one, the thing that shines out, the difference between 12.3.4 and 21.2.1 is that the former doesn't talk about protecting the landscape, protecting, maintaining or enhancing, talks about avoiding, remedying and mitigating. As a planner, Mr. White, which is the more appropriate in an O&L?
I'm just looking at those wondering if there is a practical difference between those two. You have the rural objectives which seek to protect, maintain and enhance landscape, and then the rural visitor objectives you have avoid remedying or mitigating adverse effects on landscape.
So that's your opinion that there's no practical difference?
Yes.
There is no correct.
That's correct.
And the right hand half of the right hand side of that same comparison, council's approach is that provisions for designation are only available to the designating authority. Presumably they must be available to the lessee to use.
That would be my argument as well.
Well, my argument as well, but I was taught to be wrong. But in terms of that...
And I can think of a couple of examples where that's the case. Mr. Todd might have expressed recently
right.
For the water sports program on the reserve. And the airport designation, for instance. Where council's position is that if it's works undertaken by the designating authority, that the designation is available to use. But if it's not by the designating authority, or slightly outside the conditions of the designation, the provisions of the underlying zoning.
So it must be the actual acts of the designating authority and not its agents?
Yeah.
No problem. Page. to one of our wastewater treatment, wastewater disposal, the second full box. Should we know that appropriate wastewater treatment is feasible on the site for the planned extension as a precondition zoning? Like it's very easy as you've done to say, well, that's no RC function, no RC can worry about it. But in terms of our responsibility considering rezoning, should we know that it's at least feasible to deal with it appropriately? And do we?
We've currently employed some consultants to look at that, and they've provided us some information on
infrastructure. We've briefly touched over it, and we've put in saying that we'd like to extend our accommodation a lot further. And with the present schemes and systems they have in place, the one that we are currently looking at can be extended and extended, and he saw no problem with putting separate systems in that can be utilised by clusters or groups of
That was for on-site. That was for on-site disposal. We were looking at that for the area.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Todd, how do you suggest we deal with this? The burdens have given us comfort. Is it possible to get something from? Well, I'm not going to ask Mr. White if he knows about on-site disposal systems, because I suspect he's not qualified in that field.
I wouldn't have thought that it's something that you do, just thinking about it in the sense that if you look at rezoning a piece of land, rural visitor, would you go to that level of detail? And I think the answer, given my knowledge of the rural visitor zones around, that I'd be very surprised if the council, when they sought to rezone those sites, was aware of the specifics of how wastewater would be dealt with.
No, I'm not talking about the specifics.
They probably made the assumption, like most things, they can be engineered to provide a solution for it. It's an engineering matter rather than a planning matter.
Well, I suppose,
well, knowing that you'd need to get consent, obviously, like we said, from the regional council.
But what's going through my mind is that the way that this, what I've reacted to is that there is a specific objective for safeguarding life supporting capacity of water. This is obviously a sensitive site being right next to the lake. Yes. There's no similar objective in the rural visitor zone. I think that's my recollection, is that there is a strategic objective in Chapter 3 of the subject, yes. As I say, I'm not saying that we need to know the detail, but I think the question is, do we need to know that there is a feasible option that could be employed if the burdens are able to satisfy the Otago Regional Council? So to be able to tick that particular planning box, and if so, is it possible to get, if only a one pager from whatever the consultant is?
Yeah.
Because I'm conscious that in
I would put the answer is yes, it's possible to get a one pager.
You know, we don't want a detailed story of wastewater design.
Understand.
We just want to know that.
We may not get that by Friday.
Mm. Yes. Well, we get done a lot of that work.
Yes. Well, that's a good sign. It's a, as I say, the 14th is the drop dead deadline.
Yes.
Of course, there's one other thing too that matters, is that Mr. Glaston's comments included within this, the past comments, and paragraph 3.12 of this class evidence. There's a quote from Mr. Glanner, and it was designed to connect to the Howell wastewater stream. This would have to be a pump and the wastewater main would have to be upgraded. So there is an alternative if on-site wastewater isn't available, just to connect just to the circulated wastewater network.
Well, that's a good answer. Thank you for that.
The belt and brace press approach.
Well, in that case, I'll leave it to you if you think it's desirable to put before us the plan, some evidence that plan A is feasible. The only other question I have for you, Mr. White, is that do we need to be concerned about potential traffic issues? And if not, why not?
No, I don't think you need to be concerned about potential traffic issues in this case, because what is proposed is exactly the same as the activity that's currently occurring on site. We have a proposed rule that limits site coverage. And you also have the comfort in this case that the road adjacent to the campground is a state highway and so administered by NZCA.
Will the NZCA have to give formal consent if the nature of the use in terms of the limited access rules under the whatever those regulations are?
I believe they will.
Yeah, that was my understanding, but you might have an access way, but if you're going to change what's on the other end of it, you need to go back to them.
Bearing in mind there is no constraint on what's there now in terms of depth, people can access the lake via that existing access way at the moment with no restriction on numbers.
Now, should we? I'm looking half on spot, but I'm anxious to finish your case.
Well, I think if I could just have Mr. Espy quickly.
Well, take it. Well, I wonder if we should all stand up for 5 minutes and, well, I suggest it's done at a previous witness on an occasion like this. They can do cartwheels.
Yes.
Well, Espy's got a volunteer. We'll just take 5 minutes, German, just to rest up, and then we'll complete the case about 19.